Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Joseph John. Hello, Joseph. It's a pleasure to talk with you today. We have so much in common that I hope we'll be able to explore today. But I want to begin with this transition that you made from attorney to filmmaker. And all, how did that, what was that impelling? What was that journey inside of yourself that went to from this field to the field of filmmaking?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis, for inviting me to the show. It's my honor.
My pleasure.
Well, the transition from practicing to filmmaking has never been a conscious choice.
Mm-hmm.
It all happened because of one trip that I made to Cuba. And when I ran into a taxi driver who happens to be of ethnic heritage.
Yes.
I am Korean American myself, born
yes.
in the States, raised in Korea, and came back here for secondary education, going on to college and law school and practicing for a few years. I never intended to make a full career switch necessarily. I still, in fact, don't think that I'm a full-fledged filmmaker still to this day. But it just happened.
Well, it is, you have actually created, gone through pre-production, into production, into post-production, mm-hmm. developed a film.
Mm-hmm.
You're a filmmaker.
Sure.
You are full-fledged. Every single bit of your feathers, all of your feathers are fledged. You are completely out there. All right, now continue with this process. So you're in Cuba, and you see, what did you learn that set you on fire?
So I've always been interested in this notion of identity, right?
Yes.
Especially as someone, you know, someone who's of color, who's lived and was raised in Korea, I've always questioned
yeah.
what it means to be an ethnic Korean outside of my motherland, Korea, or what it means
yes.
to be, let's say, a Korean American, Korean hyphenated, anything. Right.
Yes.
So the idea of diaspora, it's a term that's often thrown around to perhaps describe,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Jewish people and other older ethnic group, their migration from, you know, their homeland to elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
is something that I've always had a keen interest in, especially when it came to Korean diaspora. So I've been fortunate to travel to, you know, different parts around the world where I've always run into, let's say, Korean ethnic Chinese in China, Korean ethnic Japanese in Japan, Korean ethnic Russians in Russia, Korean ethnic South Africans in South Africa, and so on. Korean Brazilians, Korean Germans, and you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to Cuba for backpacking, this is shortly after President Obama announced a move to normalize relations with Cuba.
Yeah.
I wanted to be one of those Americans who experience Cuba as is before everyone else comes. So
yes, when the infection truly makes it there. Yes.
Yes. And you know, little did I know that the nature of my trip will quickly change when I got off the airport and hopped into a taxi, and the taxi driver, I look at her, she's ethnic Asian, right? So I'm like,
okay.
It's weird,
okay.
First Cuban I meet in Cuba, it happens to be of Asian origin. and so,
wow.
Yes, indeed. So I ask her, oh, would you happen to be Chinese? Because just probability-wise, there's more Chinese than Koreans in the world. And she
Absolutely.
Says, no, I'm third generation Korean. My grandpa was sold as a slave 100 years ago, my father fought in the Cuban Revolution with Fidel and Che. And that changed the course of my life. Yeah.
And all right, so that happens. Mm-hmm. What happens next? How do you begin? This churns inside of you? Do you say, okay, what do I mean? Because you don't have a background. If I understand this, your background was not in film, or your background was not. Is it?
No, not necessarily. Although I did study media studies back in college, so I had maybe
nice.
Little amateurish knowledge on, you know, what it takes to make a film, what
yes.
it takes to make a clip. And that's all I had. I never had a professional experience as a filmmaker. And yet, so in the beginning, Dennis, when I came back to New York, and by the way, I spent two more days with the entire family, traveling with them, getting to learn about their history, learning about
yeah.
the taxi driver's father, whose name is Jeronimo, who's the main character in my feature-length documentary titled aptly
yeah.
after his name, Jeronimo. So yeah, I come back to New York, and it was really truly one of those moments where I don't know if you believe in God, Dennis, but I'm not
yes.
describing Jeronimo as a god or any of that sort. But I'm just saying the profound experience of having run into a character that is larger than life and
yes.
something that I've never been taught in Korean school or any historical context. I felt like I've discovered a hidden gem that can really inspire us, not only as a Korean, but as a human being and, you know, as a member of, you know, the larger humanity or global citizenship. I had this burning desire to tell his story because
yes.
not only was he a Korean Cuban revolutionary, but he also dedicated, you know, the latter half of his life trying to reconstruct his Korean identity within Cuba. That fight for, you know, one's heritage, one's cultural identity, and one's
yeah.
legacy in history, to me was really a universal story that transcends any cultural, ethnic boundaries. So I came back.
How beautifully
to New York
said, Joseph. Just beautiful. That really connects me to the theme, the throughput of what you're doing in the story. You returned to New York and.
So initially I wrote about my experience on my social media, you know, Facebook and whatnot,
uh-huh.
and. The response from both friends and strangers alike was just really overwhelming. There were they too had a burning desire to know more about this history. So I decided to return to Cuba with maybe a couple friends of mine to make, you know, let's say a 10-20 minute YouTube clip on the
yep.
family, right? And so I raised I did a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign, and
mm-hmm.
little did I know, I raised three times more than I initially intended to raise. And this is when I knew that, okay, like I cannot just turn this into a YouTube clip. Maybe this deserves to be told in a more professional cinematic fashion. So
exactly.
instead of bringing two people, I brought five people with me. And instead of, you know, bringing a camera or two, we brought three, four cameras with us with the, you know, professional sound guy and whatnot. So over the course of next 2 years, it would evolve into something that I had initially not imagined I would be doing, which is to make a feature-length documentary.
Amazing. That is amazing. And then so you began to build this. What were you learning about the creative process of filmmaking and the creative process of doing this as you were in this, as you were in the development phase of and shooting and looking at the edits and looking at the rough cuts and beginning to tell me about that experience as you began to build the story. What themes began to come and get clear to you that you wanted to then put onto the screen?
So it was the year 2016, July, when I went back to Cuba with my friends who were working in the media and, you know, film industries to make this dream come true. And so since 2016, July, until I would say April of 2018, I shot over 200 hours of footage. I traveled to over 17 cities around 4 different countries. I met with over 60 people and probably interviewed around 65 people total. And throughout this whole process, Dennis, let me be completely honest with you. I had no fucking idea what I was doing. Excuse my language.
And thank you for sharing that, because that is the truth. I get it. Bless your heart.
Now in hindsight, I have no idea how I pulled it off. I don't know what was really truly the driving force behind all that energy and sheer passion.
Exactly.
Yes, you know, the only information, solid information I had on this one character, Jeronimo, is that his family has incredible history of migrating from Korea in 1905 to Mexico, where they were indentured servants. And after 15 years of working and hard labor, they migrate. They sort of escape to Cuba, where they're awaited another, you know, second chapter of another indentured servitude, until the revolution came, right? And that's the only solid information. And another information was that Jeronimo participated actively in this Cuban revolution as a clandestine agent, whereas Fidel and Che were fighting the Sierra Maestra in the jungles as the militia. Jeronimo was supplying those materials, you know, arms, medical equipments and whatnot to those guerrillas in the jungle. So that's the only information that I had, but I didn't know whether Jeronimo is truly a film character worthy of a character that, you know, a movie can be made out of him for, you know, 90 minutes or so. So, So, you know, with that little source that I had, I started contacting everyone that I could whose life have once crossed paths with Jeronimo at some point in their lives. And so I actively started, interviewing them. And the more interviews that I've gotten, the more I realized that Jeronimo was more than just a Cuban revolutionary. There's actually a twist to the latter half of his life where he... whether he not necessarily renouncing his the first half of his life as a Cuban person, but reflecting what's really important in his life and searching for a different half of his identity in the latter half of his life, which is searching for his roots. And so I would say the entire film was made in the editing room, and I edited for 10 months straight full time, from, you know, 10 to 6 every day with a Cuban editor. So, and you know,
in Cuba?
No, actually here in New York. I turned my little,
well, of course, New York, the crossroads of the world, going to So you have a Cuban editor who both knows Cuba and also knows Spanish and the language that is working through, right?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, so there you're editing. So that editing process, how, like when you're right in the middle of it, Where did the doubts emerge and then the other places and that keeps you going during that process? Because I've been through it. I've edited. I've been in television. I'm 71 this year, and I've been in television since 1976. And I've spent, weeks and weeks in editing bays, not done a feature film like you have, but I've done I've done pieces and that. So I know my experience. I'd love to know what your first experience was.
So I didn't have a clear script in mind going into editing.
Mm-hmm.
The film could have turned into 20 different versions.
Isn't that the truth? Whose story is it and how?
Yes. So I think in the actual film, maybe about 15 to 20 people appear on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So that means we had to cut out 45 different other people who were interviewed for the film.
Yep.
There's multiple characters that are so appealing and interesting that another film could have been made out of those characters who actually don't make into the actual film. In fact, I'm turning one of those characters into a short documentary as we speak. And that's to be discussed perhaps later at a later time.
I would love to count on it.
There's a discussion with my Cuban editor as to whether I should appear in the film. Initially, my basic instinct was that, no, I don't want to be in the film. I don't want to ruin the legacy of Jeronimo. Who am I to dare to appear and sort of lead the story? But I think the revelation came when we started editing the piece without my presence in it. The film started to look like an amateurish attempt at making, let's say, a BBC documentary on a person, a historical person. That's when we realized that, okay, Joseph, the true merits of this film and this journey becomes alive when you appear in the film. You become the storyteller of taking the audience into this journey of identity, of diaspora, of one's self-revelation. So we took that approach. I started actively more engaging in the overarch narrative of the film, where I started to narrate the film. Before, no narration was in my mind. I just wanted to tell the story as it is. Yeah, and little by little, things were coming together. But the biggest challenge was, Dennis, is I've only made a couple short documentaries before, not longer than 15 minutes. So when I had, let's say, 20 different sequences on different, narrative of episodes of the film, I didn't know how to tie them together because it looked like 20 different versions of little short segments of that does not necessarily tie with each other. So that was very, very difficult. And I think narration took care of some of those the transitional issues. In other cases, I had to completely merge the two or three sequences together so that it much shorter. Yeah. If anyone asked me what the formula or the know-how was, I would say I have no idea how it turned out. Yeah.
And it isn't, because it's a process of discovery as mm-hmm. you continue to go through it.
That's true.
I'm so glad that your editor convinced you that this has to be a first person story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful that
happened, because that makes it come alive. That makes me want to care
mm-hmm. exactly.
about it. So tell me what you learned about some of the things, not just one thing, but tell me some of the things that you learned about yourself and your being a Korean American, being a citizen of the world, being a human being in this process that you've discovered during this time, and then we'll branch off from there.
Sure. I think in the beginning of the process, and this is something that I've been thinking a lot about throughout, you know, my college and law school years, and even as a working professional.
Sure.
What does it mean to have a dual identity in America? I mean, America theoretically is a country of immigrants. Everyone came here at some point in their lives, or their ancestors have. But what does it really mean to be? It poses two questions. What does it mean to be an ethnic minority in the U.S. and what does it mean to be
exactly
a Korean outside of Korea?
Yes.
And so my struggle always has been a binary approach. Am I Korean or American? One thing I can say I learned throughout Hedonimo, producing Hedonimo, is that judging by the life of Hedonimo Lim himself, it might sound like a cliche, but not only was he 100% Cuban and 100% Korean at the same time, I think the people who often tend to struggle with, you know, dual or multi-identities often mm-hmm. end up transcending those dual identities and become something else. And
exactly.
what they become, as was the case of Hedonimo, is that he became a humanist. He wasn't a nationalist of either country. He transcended that level. So ultimately, what he truly cared for wasn't a country or an institution or this notion of homeland, but it was really caring for the people, irrespective of where they come from necessarily, right? Because he knows, after becoming comfortable with who he is, after being empowered to discover his true identity, I think what he deeply cared for is this humanity, right? So that's something I picked up from Hedonimo. That's the profound lesson that I learned throughout this process, is becoming comfortable with who I am. And ultimately, it's not about just America or Korea. It's about everyone else too, right?
That's a profound experience. I know that I'm Mexican American. I was born
mm-hmm.
in Mexico, came here as a small child. So I have that dual identity. And when people say, "Well, you don't look Mexican," and I tell them, "Look, Mexican is a nationality. It's not a race. We have we go from the whitest of white to the blackest of black in Mexico. We have German Mexicans. We have French Mexicans. We have just understand that we're not even talking the same not just language, but we're not talking about the same thing. So I have that sense. So when I heard about when Renee Jaworski, the amazing, extraordinary light that she is, told me about
mm-hmm.
you, I said, please, if there's any way that I could have a conversation with you, because I have that sense too. I want to know how we can be more human and both have our differences, our separations, but we all come, if we had, let's say that our center, the one, was the radiant place, and all these rays ray out, exude from that, they're all exactly, the rays are the same, they just come from a different degree point. But that's our commonality. And if we explore that, if I can explore that in you, and you can explore that in me, what possibilities could there be?
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is tremendous. All right. So now you've gotten it. You begin putting this together. It starts getting these 200 hours down into a 90-minute documentary. You now have to think about distribution, or how along the way did you begin to think about distribution? Did you begin to send out clips to people? What was that process like?
That's a whole nother beast, as you know.
And
it's a completely different game, really, right? Like, what makes you a good filmmaker doesn't necessarily make you someone who has a keen mind on distribution. That's just another expertise that's required. And me, like any other novice, I had no idea what I was doing. And I started submitting my film to different festivals. And, you know, again, I think unless you get into, let's say, the top-notch film festivals recognized by the world, like the Sundance or South by Southwest,
sure.
Tribeca, and so
or
on.
Cannes or some
right.
of it, yeah.
Cannes, yeah. Which I knew that virtually I would have a very little chance of getting into because,
right.
you know, not only is just the quality of the film, but it's also your expertise, your name brand, and how who do you know, your connection within those film festivals.
Oh, you mean those little things, those
yes,
little
yes,
human
yes.
things. Yes, yes, yes.
The trivial elements, other elements. and you know, and also I do recognize the shortcomings of my own film, although I've done the best as I could have. And, you know, so I ended up getting into, I would say, the second tier regional film festivals within the U.S.
Good.
And some in Korea and elsewhere. Did any distribution deals come out of these film festivals? No, but it started getting some reviews and some hypes on social media. Good reviews by the audiences as well as the critics. But this had nothing to do with the distribution deal because when we say distribution, you know, largely it's a theatrical distribution and maybe
yep.
online streaming distribution and maybe some
exactly.
TV, right, some TV deals, none of which I was fortunate to have in the U.S., but in Korea I got some traction.
Wonderful.
Yes,
did you go back to Korea to show the film?
Absolutely. Actually, so
tell me about that experience, please.
Absolutely. Sure. So I had two distribution deals in Korea. Notably, one was the TV production distribution where Korea, just like America, has an Independence Day. If in the U.S. it's July 4th, Korea is August 15th. This is when Korea
yeah.
was liberated from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the largest holiday in Korea. A Korean TV channel looking for interesting sources or subject matter, we got in touch with the broadcasting channel, and they took interest in my film. They thought Koreans in Cuba is a novel subject matter that they had not previously dealt with. So they turned a theatrical version of my film into a TV version. So they edited it. Actually, I was the one who was editing it. We cut it down to 55 minutes. So it aired on the Independence Day in Korea, which got more traction in Korea.
Nice.
And, yes, yes. It was this is first time I made my parents proud. they're questioning
that they may have said so. Okay, but still, yes. But you felt it. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. Because for 2 years, I'm sure they were wondering. Okay, my son.
Wait a minute. We paid for law
exactly.
school. We encouraged you through law school, and you're in Cuba making
Absolutely.
A film.
So yeah, I mean they've always told me on the surface, yeah, they support me, they got my back, they're praying for me. But I'm sure deep inside, there's no output for 2 years. They've been wondering, oh, is this really gonna happen? But airing
yeah.
on the public channel on the Independence Day was, I think, the first moment when they felt
oh.
a sense of deep relief that this is going somewhere.
Oh, how wonderful. And how did it feel to have the Koreans respond?
Yes. So, you know, because my heavier focus was on the theatrical release.
Yeah.
I didn't want to show too many cards on the TV version. I made it
sure.
in such a way that it's good enough, but not quite. I did want to reserve those 35 minutes for a surprise. Luckily,
nice.
I met a wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, please.
No, I said that was difficult. I'm sorry. I'm in my editor phase. I'm in my production, sitting with you in that those long nights and scratching my head phase in my head. So I'm with you there. Now I'm trying to come back to Blog Talk Radio and actually be the host and do that and be more separated from it. So anyway, I'm really engaged. All right, keep going.
No, I appreciate you joining me in that journey. But I was so lucky. I met an independent film distributor who generally distributes a smaller, you know, indie budget type of films. He took a liking in the film. He generally only distributes films with Christian faith messages.
Yep.
But My film is not an overly a faith-related film, although there are some elements where, you know, how religion comes into play in the Cuban, in the minds of Cuban communist idealists.
Of course.
Yes, but he took a liking in the film and he said, hey, let me distribute your film. So on November 21st, 2019, this is 3-4 months ago, we had a theatrical release in 60 theaters in Korea. That was like a dream coming true. When I first went to Cuba with a GoPro camera and hopping into a taxi thinking that I'm going to make one of those travel vlogs for 5 minutes, me traveling to different places, experiencing cigars and rums and salsa and whatnot. You know, from that imagination to this opening in theaters officially in Korea is just an unimaginable jump. And I was extremely grateful for it. Nationwide, it drew about 20,000 audiences.
Nice.
It actually has one of the highest audience ratings from out of all the movies that came out in 2019, even to this day.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But
Were you able to sit or stand in the back of one of the theaters as it was playing?
Absolutely. Many.
What
at
was
least
that experience like? The baby that you had, the idea from that cab, from the moment you sat in that cab and heard this beginning to standing in the back of a film as it's airing. Oh my God.
Certainly there's a sense of a personal achievement and a realization of my dreams. But Dennis, as I alluded to in the beginning of this talk, my truest passion wasn't necessarily the filmmaking itself. It was really the message I wanted to convey that there are so many Koreans living outside of Korea. And in Korea,
yep.
I don't know if you know, but Koreans in Korea tend to question the authenticity of Koreans living outside of Korea. Their authenticity
is always
questioned.
No, I did not know that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a heavy rift between the members of diaspora and Koreans in Korea, mainly because of ignorance. And, you know, South Korea had to also deal with its, you know, economic development throughout the 60s, 70s, their democratic movement through the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. Now the whole reunification, I mean, they're too busy domestically that they don't have the bandwidth to think about the people outside of the country. As a result, you know, the members of Korean diaspora, whenever they come to Korea, they experience some sort of discrimination because they don't think they're not recognized as authentic Korean by virtue of their lineage, where they come from, you know, their lack of fluency in speaking Korean, whatever it may be. By highlighting the lives of Koreans in Cuba, I wanted Koreans in the motherland to recognize that there are these people who are so few and far in between in numbers, are trying so hard to revive and reconstruct their sense of Korean identity outside of the motherland. I want them to recognize these efforts and accept them as their fellow brothers and sisters. I mean, that was my number one goal. And for me to witness how people were emotionally moved by the lives of Koreans in Cuba and those theaters was a much greater sense of achievement than just the fact that my film is playing in Korean theaters. Yeah.
I agree, because that's what drove you in the beginning.
Exactly.
It needs to be what drew what was driving you at the end.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That is wonderful. Well, in our last few minutes, Joseph, I know I've taken you over the top of the hour, and we're extending this a little bit because we had the hiccup at the beginning, which the audience won't hear, but that's okay. Thank you, God. is there anything you want to say on this particular episode that we haven't talked about that is important, that is going on right now or going on in your head about this experience of making Geronimo and where you're going and where you're distributing and what are your next steps?
Interesting that you asked me, because recently I wrote a short blurb on my social media about the relationship between the metaphorical relationship between the coronavirus and human migration.
Yes. And for the audience, just for reference point, we're doing this interview on March the 3rd, 2020, so anybody can look historically at that. Continue.
These days I've been going around a lot and speaking with various scholars and people who are studying on the topics of, you know, human migration, identity, diaspora, minority, majority, binary approaches and things of that nature. And I come to think that, there's the narrative change between the previous administration and the current administration in the way they looked at the migrants or the refugees and the strangers, the foreigners, and welcoming them into our homeland versus, you know, pushing them back and saying, go back to where you come from. When I look at coronavirus and the way people react to this disease, I mean, they're not the right comparison at all, but just because these two topics have been in my mind for the past month or two, I've come to make some correlation between the two concepts metaphorically, not literally. It's a test of humanity.
Yes.
Both the way we deal with the virus and the way we welcome strangers into our homeland.
And I think
the way we look at many countries, some countries are entirely blocking the entry into our land from other countries. I mean, rationally, that might make sense. And maybe that's a prudent thing to do scientifically, just to block the spread of disease. But oftentimes, that very mindset elevates and becomes a racist or xenophobic rhetoric. As was the case in Korea in regards to the Chinese, not only was Koreans advocating for the blockage of entry of Chinese, but they were throwing all these racial epithets against Chinese people living both in Korea and, you know, Chinese living in China. And just to witness that, how vulnerable we are to go from just being a rational human being to becoming a racist to protect ourselves. I couldn't stop but thinking about, as a test of humanity, that the history will judge how we react to these situations. And
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And we need to...
And this
how
beautiful. I'm only because we're coming at the end of the program, because I literally could talk with you for hours on this subject. And all I'm asking you, Joseph, is would you consider having another show with me where we can dive deeper into this? Because I agree with you. This is a virus can be mental, can be part of our thinking on how it works and the testing that we're needing to do and getting from our lizard brain into the higher ways of thinking and relating and the communitarianism of what we need to do in humanity. All of these subjects are barely, and I would love to hear everything you have to say on it.
I'll be honored to, but not being an expert, these are just some thoughts that are running through my head. And
I'm only Joseph. I'm not interested in your expertise of the world. I'm only interested in your expertise of Joseph, John.
Sure.
That is who you give me. That you give me your experience, strength, and hope. Give me your journey, just like you said, just like your wonderful editor said, we must have your first-person point of view. That's what I'm looking for, because if we find our commonality through the stories of others, we will find our humanity.
Amen. Yeah.
Amen. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you so much. And thank you to Renee for connecting us. She is just an absolutely integral part of all of the work that I'm doing and certainly the work that you've done. And I look forward to us getting an opportunity to continue our conversation. Thank you, everyone. And Joseph, thank you. And we will see you.